TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Plutonium fuel for nuclear reactors. The disaster at Fukushima makes it apparent how little is known about the operation of a nuclear power plant. For example, the so-called spent fuel in the damaged swimming pools on the rooftops is many times more dangerous than the fresh, non-irradiated fuel. Also, all nuclear reactors produce plutonium that can kill in tiny amounts and can be used to make nuclear weapons. The biggest danger from the Fukushima nuclear accident comes from Unit 3 that was stocked in September 2010 with MOX. That's a new mixed oxide fuel that contains plutonium, not as a fission byproduct, but from the outset inside the fuel rods. MOX is many times more lethal than uranium, both in its composition as well as in the close margins in which it needs to be managed to avoid a meltdown, even without an earthquake and tsunami. If there ever was a moment to bring this to the attention of all who have already paid for the nuclear power project with their taxes and their health, it is now. President Obama says after Fukushima that nuclear power will remain, quote, part of the overall energy plan. Republicans, in their merciless budget cuts, leave as yet a program untouched that funds the ongoing construction of a MOX fuel generating plant at Savannah River in South Carolina. This is a conversation between Mary Olson from NIRS, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and Jackie Cabasso from the Western States Legal Foundation. It is also a rare historic document of the origins of a campaign against MOX, an analysis of the terrible pact of mutual support between utilities, weapons makers, and bought-off congresspeople. Jackie Cabasso took on the role of the interviewer. Here she is.
Okay, why don't we just back up a step and talk about nuclear fuel and nuclear reactors, just the real basics. Where does nuclear fuel, uranium fuel, come from, and how is it made into fuel for nuclear reactors? And what does it mean when fuel becomes spent?
Well, those are all good questions, but we have to start with that word spent. The only thing spent about anything nuclear is the money. There is nothing spent about what is properly called irradiated fuel, and that's the end point of your question. It's the fuel once it's been used by the reactor to generate electricity. And let's start with that point for just a moment. When atoms are split, out comes a tremendous amount of energy, part of which is converted almost immediately to heat. And the heat is siphoned off through the liquid coolant and turned into steam. And the steam is used to turn turbines that make the electricity. At the same time, it's generating massive amounts of new radioactivity. As you asked, where does this fuel come from? Well, uranium is an element that's in the earth. It's mostly buried deep in the earth because life itself doesn't need it, and so the soils have built up on top of it. It has not been in the cycles. Human beings go out and dig it up. It's processed in many steps. It is radioactive. It is a health hazard. The miners who dug up the uranium have suffered greatly in their health, particularly lung cancer. The communities that have been affected by mining, and then the various steps of processing, because uranium has to be very highly processed to make fuel for reactors through 6 separate steps, including turning it into a gas and concentrating a particular type of uranium, which is the same one that can be used for making nuclear bombs, but in a reactor situation, it's in lower concentration. So once this uranium is processed, it's turned into fuel rods, and those fuel rods are moved around the country to the 103 reactor sites, and they are radioactive, but I have to tell you, my dear sweet mother had the idea that somehow the radioactivity was used up when the electricity was made. And as I said a few moments ago, when the uranium is put into the reactor, the splitting of those uranium-235 atoms actually makes new radioactivity, and that fuel becomes millions of times more radioactive than the uranium that came out of the ground. In the course of about 3 years, they're trying to push that up longer, the fuel has to be taken out because it has become so full of what are called fission products, which are the cesium, the strontium, the radioactive iodines. All of these different radioactive elements get in the way of the fuel generating the heat that's needed, and so it's removed, and the industry now calls it spent fuel. And as I said, it's now very expensive stuff. It has to be safeguarded. It has to be kept from melting. The heat from radioactive decay that continues even after it's taken out of the reactor core is so great that the fuel itself will melt if it's not cooled for at least 5 years in liquid. And even after that, it will spontaneously combust. And so this fuel made from uranium is really very nasty stuff. And the other thing that we need to point out here is that when uranium is put into a reactor, plutonium is formed in the process of using the uranium fuel. Every single reactor on the planet that uses uranium fuel generates new plutonium. And so in the U.S., our reactors generate about 1% of the total weight of fuel by the time it's taken out is now plutonium. So indeed, the largest stock of plutonium in the world is in used reactor fuel or irradiated fuel. Now, I should stop. You should ask me another question, but I want to point out that in other parts of the world, that plutonium is harvested from reactor waste. We haven't been doing that in the United States. We've been simply storing the fuel as a waste.
Isn't it true that the United States has historically had a kind of firewall between commercial nuclear power and military nuclear technology for bombs? And what we're talking about now is actually using plutonium from dismantled nuclear weapons to burn as fuel in nuclear reactors. So could you talk a little bit about that historic separation and what you see as happening there?
Sure. I want to just capture the moment to say that the reactors were designed for uranium fuel. So one of the challenges we're facing is a complete experiment of going to plutonium fuel. Now, sadly, it's not all nuclear weapons, and even more sadly, there's lots of evidence that new nuclear weapons are being made at the same time. Nonetheless, it raises the new question of what the hell do you do with the parts so that you can be sure that they don't become nuclear weapons again. And I'll tell you right now that that's what this whole program for plutonium fuel or MOX fuel is supposedly about. It's supposedly about making plutonium in the United States and in Russia from dismantled nuclear weapons, quote, safe. The sad thing is that not only is it making nuclear power even more unsafe, it's also becoming a very thin cover over a renewed nuclear weapons production program in the United States. So it's very difficult for me to give any credibility to the idea that this program is, in fact, making anything safe. But that's how it's being sold. Now, yes, there has supposedly been a great separation between the production of nuclear weapons and the production of nuclear energy, electricity. But I have to laugh at that, too. Westinghouse built the reactors for making electricity, and Westinghouse got the contracts to make the bombs. Where's the separation, I ask you? General Electric built the other competing reactors, the GE Mark I's and Mark II's, that are no better than Chernobyl, have no containment to speak of, undercut the Westinghouse model. And they also, for many, many years, were prime contractors on nuclear weapons. But in any case, there's been a supposed firewall. Now, what's changing, and truly is changing, is that in the past, nuclear power has enjoyed a lot of government support in its development, in formulating an insurance policy in case of major accidents called the Price-Anderson Act, in the waste, nationalizing the waste program. So there's been many supports for commercial nuclear power from the government. But the plutonium fuel program will give them a role in a national security mission, and they will receive not only their costs, but direct compensation for performing this function. And in an era of supposed competition between different sources of electrical energy, the reactors that use the plutonium fuel will be effectively underwritten with U.S. tax dollars, a check in the mail, first time ever, in order to keep the reactors able to outcompete any other form of energy so that they can continue to operate throughout the 20 years or however many years it takes to, quote unquote, dispose of the plutonium.
Can you just give a quick definition of the Price-Anderson Act?
The Price-Anderson Act was an amendment to the Atomic Energy Act because commercial nuclear reactors could not find private insurance for their operations. The insurance industry said, no, we will not insure you. And so the Congress stepped in and created a little funny thing. And I'm putting it that way because I find it very interesting. There's a pool of money that each reactor pays into every year that's about $100 million all told. If anything happens in the United States that costs more than $100 million, all of the reactor operators that are licensed at that time to produce nuclear energy have to pay equal shares. And they do so every year for 10 years, and the current formula results in about $9 billion that would be a collective payment by the industry towards the damages. Now, most reactor accidents would cost in the hundreds of billions of dollars because they're close to urban areas. If you wanted to calculate what would happen if jumbo jets hit the Indian Point reactors on the Hudson, very close to where the World Trade Center was hit, I think it would exceed the $200 billion figure that I've heard floated. There's three reactors at that site. They've got close to 35 years of collective fuel generation. The amount of radioactivity that would be floating around Manhattan, that place would be a ghost town right now. And the economic impact on this country would be far-reaching, greater than Enron by many orders of magnitude. So the point here is that the industry, they all pay to play. One screws up, they all pay, but then they stop at about $9 billion, which is a fraction of the cost, the true cost of a real Chernobyl-style event in the United States. Chernobyl dumped the entire reactor core and contaminated vast areas of Europe, and even in the United States there was fallout. So the point is that they have limited liability conferred upon them by law, and the result is that the victims would have to pay the rest. So ultimately, those who would pay are those who would suffer.
Now, I want to say one last thing about this. The plutonium doesn't go away. While the plutonium is in the reactor, some of it is split. It releases the energy that is the heat that makes the electric power, yes. But at the very same time, mixed oxide fuel is made of both plutonium and uranium. And the uranium in the fuel generates new plutonium at the same time. So while the plutonium that's put in is reduced, new plutonium is generated, and the net reduction is possibly 1%. So this is not a way to get rid of plutonium. It's only a way to make plutonium highly radioactive, which is part of the goal of supposedly making it safer, a way to give tax dollars to selected utilities that participate in a national security mission and prop them up against any competition they might have. And here comes the real kicker. Repurify plutonium to the point where it is so pure that weapons designers or nuclear fuel designers can use it. That's why many organizations say plutonium is a waste and should be treated as a waste and is not a fuel source. And certainly the experiment of using plutonium in Europe has shown that it's not an economic fuel source. They are in debt in the plutonium industries and they're failing in Europe. And indeed, that's part of why they're coming to the United States for our tax dollars to do this program to justify their expertise. But I want to go back to the question of why is it so dangerous and talk about it once it's in the reactor. Why is it so dangerous? Reactors are not safe. Uranium fuel is not safe. There has been two major accidents and a lot of lesser-known accidents with uranium fuel in reactors. I'm speaking of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. The work has been done. The calculations have been made. If Chernobyl had had plutonium fuel in the core, twice as many cancers would result, twice as many fatal cancers, twice as many non-fatal cancers. You infer, therefore, that all the other health effects that come from radiation would also be twice as bad. Why? Because not only is plutonium much more effective at causing cancer, it's also very toxic. And reactors that have plutonium fuel in them not only make additional plutonium, they make even heavier elements like americium and neptunium. You hardly ever hear about them, but believe it or not, they're worse than plutonium for causing cancer and for toxicity. And so the reactor core is fundamentally changed by introducing plutonium as a fuel. The consequences of a reactor accident are fundamentally worse. And there's every reason to believe that an accident is more likely with plutonium in the core. And it's for precisely the reason that plutonium-239 is selected for weapons production, is because it likes to go boom. And it's much harder to control than uranium. Uranium has a very interesting attribute, which is the hotter it gets inside the reactor, the harder it is to split a uranium-235 atom. It's a natural negative feedback loop that allows the reactor operators to have a little bit of grace in their ability to control a reactor core. Weapons-grade plutonium, exact reverse. The hotter it gets, the easier it is to split it. Second attribute of uranium that helps the reactor operators is when the atom is split, out comes that energy. Well, some of the energy is in the form of particles that are highly charged, called neutrons. Uranium happens to have two releases, an initial one that's immediate and a secondary one that is seconds to minutes later. Reactors are controlled with something called a control rod, many rods that are inserted. Well, they're mechanical mechanisms that require seconds and minutes for them to move. You cannot move a control rod in a nanosecond. It is not physically possible. Well, the weapons-grade plutonium they want to put into these reactors as fuel have only one-third as many delayed neutrons, this second burst that comes out later. So control rods are only one-third as effective when you're using plutonium fuel. So the engineers, you know, they love to solve all these problems, you know. But every time there's a new problem and a new solution, I believe, and many others believe, it cuts into what's called the margin of safety. And so we have a fuel that's much more dangerous in terms of the consequences. We have a fuel that's likely to cause an accident more readily. And we're paying for it with our tax dollars.
And I just want to talk a little bit more about why plutonium is so dangerous. As you mentioned, when plutonium is in a metal solid form, it can be handled. And the skin will actually serve as a barrier to radiation. But it's when it's in a particleized or finely divided form that it's pyrophoric. It spontaneously bursts into flame on contact with air. And under those circumstances, the tiniest particle, if inhaled or ingested or taken in through a cut in the skin, could very likely lead to a cancer and to other kinds of diseases. And in fact, the Department of Energy's studies on beagle dogs at the University of California, Davis, resulted in a bunch of dead dogs. They couldn't find a particle placed in the lung that was so small that it didn't cause a lung cancer. Every one of their experimental animals died, which is another small tragedy in the world of nuclear tragedies. What are the alternatives, and specifically, what are the alternatives to plutonium storage, if you will, or disposition? And that's one question. And the other question is, what are the alternatives to this nuclear energy path that we continue to be on, despite all of the accidents, dangers, expenses, and so on?
Well, there's good news, Jackie, and we need it. But the fact is that all of this is a relic of not only the last century, but the last millennium, and I believe the last age, because we have survived the nuclear age, and if we don't do something quick, we may not. And so I think the fact of the matter is, people in every country, on every continent, are united in the perception that the world would be a far safer place if we had no nuclear weapons at all, and if we did not use nuclear energy at all. So I think, you know, as much as right now there's sort of this fervor and this fear going around about security and terrorism, underneath that is a bedrock that was identified in the 1990s and the 1980s in various opinion polls and questionnaires and research projects, that something like 7 out of 10 people in this country believe that getting rid of nuclear weapons entirely would make the world safer. And the reason I repeat that, even now, is the fact that we can look around in the grocery store, in our places of work, in our schools, and know that if we believe in nuclear disarmament and we believe in a nuclear-free world, the majority of those around us agree with us. Even if they're of a different political party, even if they're a different gender, even if they're a different age, the majority of people actually already agree with this. And the even better news is that every time the corporations try to do something like this mixed oxide fuel or new weapons production or whatever, it turns back around to the fundamental truth that this stuff is not good for us. And more people wake up and more people realize we have a problem. And so every time the nuclear industry thinks that they're moving forward, it's actually those of us who are working for the preservation of life and the healing of the planet who get to go forward, because they inevitably go backwards. And so the alternative to plutonium, well, stop making it. And where is it made? In reactors. Every single reactor on the planet that uses uranium fuel makes plutonium. So when arms control people talk about plutonium production, I start laughing, because they're just talking about the separation of the plutonium. It isn't until we turn off all the reactors that we stop actually making plutonium.
Is it 20% that's provided by nuclear power? Is that the correct number?
It is a correct number, that 20% of our electric power, not our total energy. Total energy is much less is nuclear. But electric power is 20%. However, the single largest consumer of electricity in the United States is the production of uranium fuel. It consumes 1%, which is 1/100th of the total electrical consumption of the United States. And so, in fact, the net contribution is only 19%, because if you turn off the fuel production at the same time as you turn off the reactors, you only lose 19%. How can we turn off the reactors? Well, it's really very simple. For every dollar we spend on efficiency, which is not the same thing as going without. Efficiency is when you have the same product or the same service, but you can look at the bottle and say, aha, I made this bottle with less energy than this other bottle. And they're both bottles. And it doesn't matter what the source of the energy was. If you're making the same product with less energy, that's more efficient. And efficiency has, in the United States, the capacity to displace the entire nuclear generating outfit and a good chunk of the coal generating outfit if we only came to the level of efficiency that Germany and Japan have. Germany and Japan today get 4 to 5 times more product, more service for every unit of energy than we do here in the United States. If we want to be patriotic, in my humble opinion, we need to adopt energy efficiency as our number one commitment and our number one goal. And every corporation that produces anything should be thinking about how to do it with less power. Everybody who delivers a service should be thinking about how to do it with less power. And the flip side of all this is the ability to rebuild our economy through investment in renewable energy. And if every roof in this country was a photovoltaic electrical generating roof, we could power an economy at least 3 times the size of the one we have now, just by using the roofs we have, without sacrificing another square acre of land for solar power. That's not touching wind. In the state of South Dakota alone, if the wind potential was realized, we could power the entire country at the level we are at now. So we have tremendous resources. We have the ability to rebuild our economy by investing in those resources. And through the efficient use of power, we could phase out nuclear almost overnight.
So I think you've given us a very useful prescription. And you've also let us know that it's going to take a long time, but we're going to win. I'm very encouraged. Thanks.
That was Jackie Cabasso, Executive Director of the Western States Legal Foundation, closing her conversation with Mary Olson from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service on an optimistic note. I recorded their conversation on January 26, 2002, at the end of a strategy meeting by 9 anti-nuclear campaigners on how best to resist the new nuclear programs. This meeting, organized by veteran anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott, was held in Contra Costa County, California. A sulfur dioxide cloud from a refinery accident nearby prevented us from leaving the house, and we spent the time sharing the story you just heard. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.